so many variables in this term.
Okay, anyway, as I said, welcome. I see a lot of familiar faces, and it's very nice to see you back. Thank you for coming. If there's anybody who hasn't been here before, the Arcadia Project is a project funded by the Arcadia Fund at the University Library, which is exploring the role of libraries in the digital ecosystem. And one of the things we do, apart from having fellows, some of whom are here tonight, is we have a seminar program and an annual lecture and so on. And tonight, I'm very pleased that we've got Mark Turin, whom some of you may know from other places in Cambridge. I first came across his work at a symposium in Crash, and I was, I have to say, blown away by it. I thought it was fantastically original, fantastically creative, and very, very interesting way of using digital technology to enrich our understanding of our world. And you may have noticed also that in the Arcadia lecture this year, as I said, one of the themes I'm trying to push this year is the realization that humanities are at least as interesting an area for digital technology as the conventionally accepted science and technology areas. That's news to some people, but not, I'm glad to say, to everybody. So this is part of that tradition. And next, our next speaker will be Lillian Edwards, who's a professor of internet law, but she's going to, her title is, on June the 1st, she's talking on the seminar, the title is Death 2.0, which is what happens to your digital assets when you die. When you think that Facebook, for example, has now over 400 million members, and you apply the laws of statistics to that, and you find there's quite a lot of people that pass away. And Facebook, you can't delete a dead person's account on Facebook, but Facebook will memorialise it. But then there's an ancient question of
who owns
all the podcasts and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, that's for later. But tonight, I wanted Mark to... Mark, this is
I'm
live.
I'm doing life 1.0. 1.5.
Life 1.1, perhaps. I really wanted to find out how his project had evolved from the original Digital Himalaya project. And that's what he's here to talk about. He's a linguistic anthropologist. He was trained in social anthropology at Cambridge and in descriptive linguistics at Leiden University. This means he can understand stuff that I can't. He's also held research appointments at Cornell and Leipzig. And from 2000 to 2008, he was Chief of Translation and Interpretation at the United Nations Mission in Nepal. So, Mark, I'll hand over to you if you could talk for maybe 40 minutes and then we'll have a conversation.
Thank you, John, for the warm words of introduction and for this invitation to be here at Wolfson and to have a chance to talk about what I've been doing and where I want to take it. I should say, actually, I was delighted to be present at the packed-out audience at Dan Cohen's talk on the social life of digital libraries. A fantastic presentation in which he articulated very clearly, I thought, many of the things that I've been struggling with for a while. So it was useful as well as informative, and I look forward to similar kinds of talks like that in the future. I'd like to talk about two initiatives this evening, the success of one really leading to the development of the other. I'm going to touch on some of the lessons that we learned in the process of the first project and how they informed and essentially changed the conception of the second, and also discuss the challenges and the opportunities for collaborations between humanities researchers, archivists, librarians, scholars, and perhaps most importantly, at least in the second project, source communities, as partners in kind of collaborative documentation fieldwork. I'd like to start with these three words. I take them shamelessly, but I acknowledge their origin, from the New Zealand Film Archive. I went to a talk at the Open University, actually some time back, and Sarah Davey there spoke about the Film Archive, which has, as a mission in New Zealand, to collect, protect, and connect New Zealanders with their moving image heritage. Now, these three verbs also summarise very nicely what I think we, as a small community of sort of committed anthropologists, should be doing, and also what I've been doing for a while without realising it. Essentially, these words sum up what the last decade has been for me. Collection, for me at least, is the gathering and the meta-documentation of ethnographic recordings, whether in the field or from shoeboxes, which often sit around in people's attics. And one of the things that we've come to learn about anthropologists is they're often very good in the field and quite bad at classifying, cataloguing, and organizing their data. It ends up sitting around, and if you're lucky, you get it in their lifetime. If not, it's their grandchildren who send it to you later. So collection is not an extractive or acquisitive process, but increasingly something that should be responsible, collaborative, and predicated on trust with source communities, but also the respects and the rights of scholarly producers of this knowledge. The protection, I think, should be no news to any of you, and I'm sure I'm speaking to the converted here. It's about, obviously, the archiving, the curation of the rich ethnographic content, doing the best that we can, as scholars, as well as librarians, as well, and archivists, to ensure that these unique cultural materials are maintained, migrated, refreshed, when new technologies become available. And the last point is perhaps the most interesting one, which is the connection. That's made when collections are returned to source communities, when they reach a wider public in print and online. That's increasingly, now the word impact has entered the horizon of academics for the first time in many fields, how you connect to an audience that is beyond your normal academic community and kind of the fringes of your world. So this evening's talk is really an exploration of these three verbs and what they mean for the projects that I run, for humanities research in general, and particular, again, this focus on the interests, the aspirations and needs of individuals, groups who lie outside of the confines of Western universities. As John said, I'm a linguist, I'm an anthropologist, I'm an accidental tourist in the land of the digital, so my apologies in advance if some of what I say is going to be a little pedestrian for the more serious technical librarian archivist background that some of you will hold. But I suppose that some things I will say will be self-evident to you, but they're often news to the scholars. This was the snapshot of the page from the New Zealand Film Archive. It's wonderful also because it's entirely bilingual, right, in Maori as well as in English. Digital Himalaya. Well, it started out in 2000 as a project to develop strategies and collection methodologies for multimedia anthropological information from the Himalayan region. Let me pause on one word for a minute. Multimedia. That all sounds sort of very new or now quite dated. But anthropologists have been doing multimedia before they realized that they were doing multimedia. I mean, fieldwork is an inherently multimedia experience, and particularly some of the early scholars had access to film cameras, a moving film still, audio, wax cylinders, they wrote field notes, they meta-documented their field notes. The strange thing about coming back to your home institution was that your collections were then fragmented. So what was immersive and holistic in the field became disparate and fragmented when you got back. And what would happen, people's films would go, if they were lucky, to a film archive, their documents to the university library, and everybody else, you know, could just sort of sort it out for themselves. This is what we started out. Now, why in 2000? Well, three things came together in 2000 for this project to happen. The first was an unlikely source of a tiny bit of seed money. The Royal Anthropological Institute in the UK had been given some money by a donor in the States for work on what they called urgent anthropology. And nobody had applied for a couple of years. So there's a pot of money sitting there. And we heard about it and thought, well, here's a conceit. We are not going to go and do urgent anthropology, which is actually what I'm going to come on to in a minute. We are going to do urgent anthropology of urgent anthropology. We are going to say there's stuff sitting around, which if we don't do something now with it, we probably won't have the chance to do much with it later. So the collections of yesteryear's urgent anthropology. This phrase, nitrate won't wait. Some of you all know that from 16mm film that has a tendency to self-combust after sitting around in unfavourable environments for too long. That was a sense of urgency on the collections there, the urgency of digitization. And then the technology. And again, I say this as a pedestrian, but, you know, 2000, of course, this is before Google, and with, you know, early QuickTime compressions and Sorenson codecs, you could deliver video online in an unsatisfactory but still quite exciting manner. So we thought technology, urgency, and a little bit of money, that's enough for us to kick off a little project. Now, we started out with, I would say, quite sweet, but now with hindsight, naive impressions of what we were going to do. Preserve in a digital medium the materials that were degrading in their present format. That wasn't naive. That's turned out to be an important component of what we've done. That includes photographs, audio, film, maps, publications, etc. Then this is where the naivety came in, the next two sections. To make these materials available over the web for the West and on DVD for the rest. Okay. We thought in those days, well, in Nepal, you know, I'd been in Nepal for many years before that, they'll never get the internet, you know, or if they do, it'll be so slow they won't be able to download video. Well, how wrong we were. And I'll come on later to show you how our users have changed from being, you know, Western university scholars and researchers to actually now half of our user base comes from the communities, or, no, we don't know that, from the countries where our collections originated. And on the DVD front, yes, of course, it's still possible to do that, but we get as many requests to produce DVDs from Western University colleges and institutions as we do from places in the Himalayas. So there's a kind of inversion here, and that's something that's, I suppose, also research interesting question. This is what would happen. We'd get these 60mm recordings like these. This was from a collection that Cambridge University Anthropology Museum, where I now work, didn't even know really they had 60mm films, probably some of the first moving image of Sikkim, Bhutan, Northern India and Tibet from the 30s, from a colonial officer who was based out there. Then we played it through a SteamVec 60mm player, and then I sort of put together, with a little assistance from people more technically adept than myself, this Heath Robinson-like digitization machine, where you, I mean, don't try this at home, you know. You project the film, it goes through a box of mirrors, and you film the output. So, suboptimal, I think, would be the technical term. But I want to say something about that, which is, it was cheap, it was dirty. This is the Department of Anthropology seminar room at 3 a.m, which is the only time I was allowed to do it, from sort of midnight until 6. So it was, you know, torturous work, and definitely put some grey hairs on my head. But still, what this led to was low-quality resolution film, which was good enough for people to use, and also good enough for the BBC and other production companies to say, oh, that's good. We'd like to do that professionally correctly now and pay the university for the privilege at £40 a second, or to return to heritage communities, source communities, and enrich our content based on these fairly decent, you know, but pretty homemade digital assets. This is one of the sort of products of it. This is 1931 in Tibet. For some reason that I still don't understand, and I have told them about it, this footage is not blocked by the Great Chinese Firewall. So you can watch these Tibetan soldiers marching around with waving a Tibetan flag in 1931, just outside of Lhasa. And for whatever reason, maybe it's historically interesting but not politically potent or something, but it's not being blocked. We've got a lot of this footage, but you know, universities like Cambridge and Oxford and British Museum and Library don't always know what they're sitting on. Here, an interesting opportunity comes for enrichment, for collaboration. And we took this film and footage like this from Arunachal Pradesh, one of the most interesting tribal parts of northern India. This is kind of inverse bungee jumping among the Apatani community. And this is still practiced in some way, but not so not without health and safety oversight these days. It's absolutely amazing. And, you know, we didn't even know what we had because they often weren't well documented. Now, it's easy to take DVDs of this stuff back. It's easy to put it online and enrich, of course, the content and the collections like this. It was a great pleasure to be viewing this material, but it was also a sense of, if we didn't do it, who was going to spend the time to do it? Here's a little piece of 16mm film from 1957. I show it because the next piece of film I'm going to show you is the same ritual, but shot in 1990. So what's interesting about it is, for the first time, you don't have to get on a plane to go and look at a 60mm collection, one in Cambridge and one in Utah, but you can do it, obviously, online. And it allows people interested in performative change, audio-visual materials, and also simply from the community, to see how their traditions may have changed over time or not. For example, so interesting, I think, is how little has changed in a certain way. But I mean, you've got colour, you've got zoom, you've got all kinds of technical transformations, but much of the cultural content is still the same. Showing this in Nepal generates an enormous amount of interest, and you can show the same clip 20 times, 40 times, and people are still asking questions, adding comments, talking about whether it be jewellery or people's clothes or how wealthy and plump they look or how thin they look. I mean, there's a lot that can be, you can mine a lot of information out of these collections. I would say that one of the shifts has been that we have a kind of responsibility to do something with this material. Increasingly, inaction, just saying, oh, we've got it, oh, it's all terribly ethically problematic to do anything with it, is not an option, in my opinion. You know, there are interesting collaborative possibilities, and there are ethical issues about not doing anything. You know, doing nothing is also an ethical choice, and I think increasingly it's a problematic one. So the point about the digitization in waves is that you start doing it cheaply yourself and then somebody else does it properly for you. And that is also what happened. Here I went to Sikkim in northern India. It's now part of India, but it was an independent kingdom until 1975. the point of the story is, with a little desktop DVD player, I was showing this footage, writing down what we were looking at. The lady in the bottom here, who's pointing at the screen on the old Mac, she died the year after we were there, and she was actually the only person left in Sikkim, we were told, who had a sense of what this footage might be, 1930s footage. Her son, who is to the left, who's pointing at the screen on the top right there, wearing the blue jacket, he died last year in a car crash. Now, I don't want to get into death 2.0, but I do want to make the point that there is an urgency at that end as well. You know, we're now with the last generation of people who have actually witnessed this kind of colonial era of anthropology and may have a chance to make some comments about it and say something meaningful. So I think action is imperative. Talking about this kind of digitization in waves, Edina and the Film and Sound Online Archive took the 60mm films, digitized them properly, put them all online through the managing agent and advisory service, MAS, which some of you will know. It's constantly rechanging its name. So the problem with it, as far as I'm concerned, is that you have to be a UK Federation to get access. Okay? And it seems a bit of a shame, all that time and money spent digitizing things to a high level, and then you have to authenticate through a UK higher education authority. I mean, one could not think of broadening that net somewhat. I'm sure there are issues about it, but still. What they've done is put all this footage online with a minimal metadata. We've helped them with some of the metadata and tagging and subjects, but still, it's limited in terms of who has access to it. This is what our website used to look like. Designed by me late at night with the early version of Claris Works or something. But the point of the story was it adhered to every single no-go that you could possibly dream up. It was, you know, impossible to use, badly designed, nasty colour schemes. I even had a student from some media studies major in the States write to me and say, I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to make a subject of you for my dissertation about how not to design a website. It's kind of flattering in a way. So after much consideration and soul-searching, we decided to go whole hog into Cambridge House style. It's great for us. Now, you know, XHTML compliant, we've got some Creative Commons licensing there, we're all strict and tight. Please note the Amazon things at the bottom. I'm going to come on to those in a minute. So this is an important thing for us to do, to become more serious in terms of the longevity of our web assets. And I got an email just last week from the British Library who wanted to now archive the website, which I thought was a good sign, so that's good news. I will say how naive we were when we did set up this project, really, to buy .com, because I had no idea that it really meant a commercial domain. Years later, somebody, I think in Hawaii, offered to sell me .org for $10,000, and I didn't even reply. But a year later, it came up for sale for $10, so I bought it. So now we have .org as well. But it just shows, again, how sometimes scholars don't quite know what they're doing, but the process can be interesting as well as a research initiative. Let me show you some of the collections we have on the website. So this is stuff that other countries would host themselves. So you can imagine Ordnance Survey or the Census Bureau. But here we host maps of Nepal and other parts of the Himalayas where users can select the district and the features they want, and they get a GIF or a PDF file popping up like this, and they can download it and save it. Now, this ends up being used in World Bank reports, in college term papers. In fact, this kind of simple map function is something that has ended up being very, very useful. People even write me emails saying, did you know the Digital Himalaya has these things online? I say, I do, because I put them there. I mean, they work their way around the system and get kind of re-ingested into other people's archives, which I'm fine with. The census. Well, again, Nepal has a census bureau, a very good one, actually, and a pretty bad census website. And they keep on going down. So we offered to host the census data in a simple search sort of database format, where you can start comparing districts, villages, economic literacy, population levels, and spit out the data that you need. This is used, again, by all kinds of people, and interestingly, increasingly people in Nepal and in the Himalayas. So while our model was assets that are from Nepal will be used outside, no, I mean, people in Nepal or India or parts of Tibet don't always have easy access to publications, to libraries, to, you know, archives, and it's easier for them sometimes to go to a website and download the information, bizarrely from a server in Cambridge, let's say. Music. Well, this has been one of the interesting changes, is sort of from heritage materials, old films and old documents, to providing a portal for communities who might themselves not have the digital nous about how to host something and want the visibility of being attached to a bigger project, who send us their collections. So we're now hosting or co-hosting for many different kinds of music collections from the Himalayas, often collected now, some are older, with a PDF download of the transcript and a track. So you can read it in Tibetan or in Nepali or in Hindi and listen to the audio at the same time. Now, plenty of people like to host their things on archive.org or YouTube and Flickr, and there's obviously nothing wrong with that, and we're not trying to suck everything towards us. But some people who are more academically inclined, or communities who want some visibility that is not only commercial, and they want a way to have their information passed out, give us a section of their collection and host shrewdly other parts on things like archive.org or Flickr. So I think that's an interesting relationship where you're a partial host for part of a collection, but not all of it. And you can provide, obviously, handouts back and forth to each other. Films, I'll briefly touch on that. I mean, there's a lot of work in documentary film in the Himalayas now. Fantastic visuals, obviously, but a lot of very good local filmmakers who don't have the access and the distribution techniques. So we've started hosting trailers on our website, sometimes whole films, and then saying, contact the filmmaker if you want to buy a copy. And we found this has been quite useful because we provide a little bit of visibility at the same time as providing kind of wealthier and I suppose more diverse collections than we would have originally conceived of. That's by the by, because I want to talk for about 5 minutes about journals. I mean, here we are into the core of what JSTOR and other organizations do. JSTOR, obviously, a fantastic resource if you are visible enough and regular enough, not in your sanitary habits, but as a journal publisher, to produce stuff that JSTOR wants to pick up. But if you're small, and if you don't have an ISSN number, and if you're kind of occasional, then they won't notice you. And that has been something that we have come to realize. So now we have an archive, really, I call us a JSTOR for the Himalayas now, of 30 different publications, ranging from peer-reviewed academic ones to newspapers to kind of cultural pride magazines, stuff in French, in Bhutanese languages, in Nepali. It's fantastic and very exciting to have supported this. Now, it's what we're trying to do is stimulate interest in these journals and also stimulate sales. There's no point in trying to erode this tiny market share that these poor journals have by putting modern issues up. So we have a kind of moving wall to be decided by the publisher and the editorial board together. And that's been, I think, quite an effective strategy for generating interest, and subscription rates to some of these things have gone up as a result. The great discovery, the breakthrough moment for me was when I was at Cornell as a postdoc, seeing one of those machines where you can basically photocopy and scan at the same time. I couldn't believe it. So put all the stuff in, press go, and you get a PDF out of it. And I thought, wow, this is a fantastic tool. The other fantastic tool was the work-study students. For those of you who know the American system, some people, many students who are very able but financially not in a position to pay $40,000 a year for the privilege of studying there, finance themselves by being a work-study student. So work-study students did a lot of the work to bring all this online. I mean, we must acknowledge their kind of invisible labour, their sweat equity in this process. So the journals, we have a simple system for displaying it, and now we're actually slowly archiving everything to DSpace, which is great for us, so everything will have a sort of standard and clear, transparent handle. Be important. The metadata is something that we've worked on carefully, recompressing PDFs, putting them online. Sometimes, if the PDFs have been generated from digital source files, you can, of course, search the content. Other times, you have to tag the metadata in the documents property field in the PDF. But otherwise, we've got now a large corpus. The happy news is that because a lot of the things that we have are in languages of the Himalayas, which are now, of course, all in Unicode as well, Google indexes that too. And I'm very happy for people to download our stuff without even visiting our website. I have no need to kind of suck them into our website and sort of brand them and spit them out the other end. So if you search for something like this, which for those of you whose Nepali is more rusty than it should be, it says Dura Jatiku Chinari, which means an introduction to the Dura community. If you search for that, then you get a link which is presently housed on the Social Anthropology website, and you just download the PDF right away. The journal story has been one that has been quite satisfying. The users that I mentioned, here we have a snapshot from Google Analytics showing that we get about 150 up to, sometimes on a good day, 300 users, repeat offenders, coming back to our website for more and more. I find that surprising. I mean, I'm delighted, but I mean, it's a tiny thing. The Himalayas, you know, kind of cultural content on the Himalayas. So what I've noticed is that people, once they become users, they keep on returning to download recent issues of journals, and they set up kind of reminders themselves to do so. So we have a sustained user base. And where is that user base? Well, it's no longer only in the States and Europe, it's also in India and Nepal and other parts of the world as well. If you look at the bottom, United States is first, Nepal is second, UK is third, India is fourth. I wouldn't have predicted this. I'm delighted about it, and it's really been a big change for us in terms of who's using it and how they're using our content. The workflow. This is my house in Kathmandu, and a young student who we've been employing for some years to do scanning of journals and other documents. So he scans it, he puts it on a hard disk like that, he gives it to somebody like you, and this in a way is kind of invisibility of the whole system, because it requires a shuttling back and forth of content. And the servers aren't big enough, and the speeds aren't good enough in Nepal to upload gigabytes of data overnight, right? Megabytes, sure. So somebody brings it back on the Qatar flight from Kathmandu to London, right? And they give us free air freight, so I'm quite happy about that. And then it goes on our servers. So it's a funny kind of little story, very homemade, but actually it works. It doesn't have to be more complex than that. At the moment, we are putting a lot of stuff online, and we're generating a lot of new content at the same time. To talk for a couple of minutes about sustainability, well, funders, research councils, are very eager to sort of support startups. I call them sort of venture capitalist research councils. But it's very hard to find money for maintenance and sustenance and endurance. Yeah, okay, there were resource enhancement grants like the HRC ones, although they stopped, and then the Arts and Humanities Data Service folded in 2008. I mean, what do you do when you're going and you want to kind of continue for the long run? So the British Academy funded us, the Department of Education in the States funded us, the Royal Anthropological Institute funded us. But none of them are going to fund us to keep the whole thing alive and to slowly, incrementally improve, redo the website, etc. So I set upon this technique of Amazon. Now, I spoke about this recently to colleagues in Germany, and they said, oh, that's interesting, we've never thought of that. But one American student in the audience said, oh my God, you're going to the dark side with this. You know, he was just from Berkeley and felt that this is all very, very unkosher. The model with Amazon for us has been also an interesting one. I don't know if anybody knows how this works, and if all of you do, then my apologies. But basically, if you search through our website on Amazon, UK, USA, or Germany now, and find something you like and purchase it, we, not you, not Amazon, get 4% of your sale. That's money that otherwise Amazon probably would be paying to Google if you search through them. We have found this to be interesting in two ways. It generates a tiny amount of money. You can imagine it's not much, particularly if you buy second-hand books. But most importantly, actually, it generates a kind of commitment from a community of users. I mean, communities don't emerge spontaneously. They require kind of some curation and management. And our digital Himalaya user base, whether they be academics in the States or, you know, journalists in the UK, are happy to do this because they also feel that they're contributing to something in a very sort of light way without doing anything that they wouldn't otherwise do. So I find it, so far, it generates a little bit of money. That's not the interesting thing about it. The interesting thing about it is it acceptable? Is it a kind of an acceptable way of advertising? And secondarily, what does it do for a community of users? Does it bind them together through some kind of common protocol? The technology has all been out-of-the-box stuff. We were lucky to be small enough as a project to not be able to invest in technology. See what I mean? We couldn't possibly employ anybody to do anything clever for us. So we had to do it ourselves and piggybacked on some of these things. And we're well advised early on to go with things like MySQL and PHP. The productivity, because now that we've moved most of our operations to Nepal, we can bring on a new collection every month. So just the last few months, we've brought on a new collection of documents or policy briefs or films or photographs every month, basically. Not on the first of the month every day, but still, we are continually adding to our collections in ways that we didn't think. We thought we were going to be on sort of life support by now. So the unexpected rewards of this project have been numerous, but the two things I'd like to focus on are this massive uptake of internet connectivity across Asia, with as many users from the region as we now have in the West, but also the more fuzzy, mushy one, which is that the energy invested in these kinds of projects is returned in kind through collaboration, volunteer time, and unlikely sources of financial support, and one of them being an academic who's a Smithsonian, who's known to be quite crotchety. She wrote me an email some time back and said, why have you stopped digitizing this journal? And I said, well, we ran out of money. And she said, what would it take to do the rest? I said, about $1,000. So she sent me a check, a personal check to me, not to a project. We didn't have a project bank account. And I thought, how interesting that something about what we've done has generated a level of trust that somebody I'm never going to meet would send me a personal check. Of course, you know, I didn't go on holiday in the Bahamas. I did actually do the work. But there's a sort of sense that when you do something and you put it out there and you hope that it's for the best, then people respond, by and large, very positively. And those are some of the things that I've enjoyed. The future steps are very simple for this project: to index, recompress all the PDFs, house everything on DSpace, which would be fantastic for us, refine the search options. Some of you may know the open journal systems that Joe Walensky and his team are coming up with. I'm interested in that because it might be a better way for us to actually index our journals. and also provide some interactivity on the website. I mean, we dreamt of years, 10 years ago now, of wouldn't it be great if you could click here and the user could add a comment? Well, this is so, you know, mundane now in anything in social networking software. So we could obviously move to something like that. That would require some rethinking technically, but it could be done. And also to continue to produce these DVDs that we do for colleges and schools who aren't on the grid, as it were, but do have power, and providing essentially a mini archive of 40 gigabytes of data for them on their own computers to search and print off as needed. In short, what we've seen happening in our project is moving from kind of colonial era collections to contemporary collections, away from the 60mm film festering away in a university archive to people writing to us saying, I've got my grandfather's footage, you know, I'm Nepali, he was Tibetan, can you host it, right? Or a small cultural community in eastern India saying, we'd like to host our journal or our films with you. We've also gone from a very exclusive model of kind of Western scholarship to more of a collaborative model, throwing it open. We virtually never turn anybody away if they're a serious, you know, contender who have interesting content that is unique and deserves wider dissemination. And the other thing that has been so unexpected has the change from Western funding, so the model of kind of research councils in the UK, the US, to, you know, now Asian donors, a bank in Nepal is giving us some money, and also this kind of community of Amazon users. So the trend we've seen, and actually that we're part of really, is a move away from archives that look like this. I mean, for many of my students now, they're never going to go to an archive like this, or at least they don't think they are, you know, and they're probably not going to go to a library like that very often either, and they're thinking less of libraries like that and more of folks like you, where librarians are, of course, the original search engine. And I think one of the exciting things for us has been the partnership with librarians, archivists, people who often, from the kind of scholarly producer perspective, are people who get things in the end but are not part of the kind of grant writing and decision-making process. Now, many of the grants that we've gotten have been very tightly linked to library collections and archive management, and essentially, you know, an incredible knowledge base. Let's build on what you know and make sure we don't reinvent the wheel, or worse still, reinvent the puncture. And archive.org, for example, is just changing how people think about knowledge. I mean, look at their tagline, universal access to human knowledge. The National Archives of the UK, who would have thought 15 years ago that their line would be bring history to life through UK government records? I mean, archives were places that things went to die. Now, archives are places where things live, and we could argue some collections, and, you know, I will mention that briefly in the last part of the talk, some collections are almost born archival, right? I mean, they're ingested into an archive in the field. Linguists particularly are now, you know, digitizing their stuff, or they're recording it digitally. It's not only born digital, it's uploaded to an archive, and immediately they're working on the archive. The archive is a site of interaction, not the place, not the repository of kind of lockdown closure. Community archives, a very interesting thing for us to follow as well, as a community of anthropologists, to see how communities self-represent themselves, what they include in their archives, and how we should be supporting that kind of initiative. I love this term, sweat equity, because I think it's exactly how a lot of invisible work gets done. I hadn't heard of crowdsourcing until more recently, but actually it sums up a little bit what we do, which is that, you know, we put stuff out there and see what people are going to do with it, and we respond quite actively to user needs. So I found that also to be a good frame to understand what we've been doing. The point of all this, well, there are four takeaway points, really. One is that the fact that Himalayan studies, and Nepal studies in particular, are small and marginal and pretty invisible scholarly communities is to our advantage. Okay, we're not stuck in traditional Indology or traditional Sinology. And that means we're able to deploy quite fast. And it also means that the networks of scholars and communities are very strong. Because you had to collaborate across great distance with people in the States and Australia, and they're eager to partake and be part of things. Digital repositories don't have to be complex, they don't have to be expensive always. I mean, you can do quite a lot quite lightly. And now you can actually make projects largely self-funded by people who you didn't think were going to give you money to begin with, but, you know, in private individuals, referrals and stuff like that. And now we've got this portal structure where we host things like the Britain Nepal Academic Council or other community archives. And we do that for free because we have a service base. Why not? So, if I have 10 minutes, John?
Yep.
Okay. In the last 10 minutes, I'd like to talk about what I'm doing now. So that was the last 10 years, basically. I've set up, in January 2009, the World Oral Literature Project, also here in Cambridge. And it's an initiative to try and document and make accessible endangered oral literatures before they disappear without record. And the project really grew out of what we realised we could do with Digital Himalaya and one of our funders, who's in the States, who liked it very much. And it really grows out also of an appreciation of what linguists have been doing now for a while. I must say, I mean, a nod to the Rousing family, to Arcadia here. Arcadia Trust, before it was called that, gave £20 million to SOAS for work on endangered languages, right, documenting endangered languages, the Hans Rousing Endangered Languages Project. That, together with money from an unlikely source, the Volkswagen Foundation, the Volkswagen Stiftung in Germany, rebooted field linguistics, which, you know, had basically been moribund since Chomsky killed it off in the 60s, and suddenly made it possible to have funding to work again. It's rather ironic that the funding should come from, you know, outside sources rather than from a desire from the community, but what happened was field linguistics has been massively revitalised, and linguists are now increasingly working on endangered languages and working collaboratively with the speakers of those languages. Now, why oral literature? Well, it's a funny term, and some people think it's kind of rather oxymoronic. How can it be oral and literature? Well, it's a term that has some traction in traditional anthropology. The sense is that there's a lot of stuff that is sublinguistic, that the language is the vehicle for the transmission of this knowledge, but it is essentially the nuts and bolts of anthropology. Increasingly, kinds of anthropology, kinds of topics of research that anthropologists, field workers, do not really focus on anymore. And linguists aren't always in a great position to collect it or understand it either. And why now? Well, there's this sense of both the juggernaut of globalization, where everything is, you know, going to hell in a handbasket, which I don't entirely believe, but also an increased interest, thanks to some of the positive spins of globalization, you know, cheap technology, people being connected, that local researchers, right, are themselves wanting to document this. And we as anthropologists have a great, I think, chance to partner with local communities and also fund some of the work and work in new, innovative, collaborative ways. Linguists have been doing it, and anthropologists sometimes haven't. This is the kind of work that I think we should be supporting, and increasingly we are doing. It's a triangulation of research interest. You've got a Western researcher on the left, you've got the kind of native knowledge holder in the middle, in this case in a rice paddy in eastern Nepal, and on the right-hand side you have the local researcher, who until recently wasn't a major candidate. And it's very hard for you to get funding if you are a local researcher. And it's very, very hard to get any funding for it as a foreign researcher, to fund a local researcher or work with them. This is the kind of funding that I think we should be providing and have been providing. So the linguists are doing a lot. You've got all these different projects working on language endangerment, language documentation, language revitalization. And what are the anthropologists doing? They're thinking about it. Some of them are doing great work. I don't want to belittle that of my colleagues. I mean, there's fantastic regional initiatives, but they're not linked up. They're not talking to each other. There's no discussion of standards. There's no discussion of classifications and categories. The one enterprise in that domain was the human relations area files at Yale, and that sort of died a sad death some years back. So, in other words, anthropologists haven't risen to the challenge of kind of cultural documentation. So what we're doing in the project is simply giving out some grants, working on putting the materials that we're getting from our grantees and from the people who sort of walk in off the street and give us collections into an archive, some publications, workshops, and occasional lectures. About these grants, we're doing something a little unusual for a granting body. We have no application form and no deadlines. Now, it's only possible because we don't give that many grants. I mean, at the moment, we're small enough to be able to do that. If we got a lot of applications or we had a lot more money to give away, we wouldn't be able to fly. This does actually mean that people who wouldn't normally be able to apply or think of applying do apply. We focus on documentation, not on theory. We're particularly encouraging indigenous researchers and community organisations to apply, like those people you saw in the last slide. And we've had 30 proposals given to us, 13 projects funded, given out about $100,000 already, and four other projects under review. So it's going well. We've had an overwhelming focus on Asia-Pacific to start with, although we're happy to be moving away from that right now. And we're looking at where the collections are going to be housed. Well, you know, as we all know, lots of copies keeps things safe, but you know, how do you actually translate that into an archival management strategy? And I think what we've gone for is kind of a multi-tiered approach. We've got things on our own website. We're looking, I'm happy to see Dan here. Where is he? Hi there. He's working, I think, quite closely on collection space, which is something that Cambridge is intimately involved in as well. We're looking at different kinds of tools, technologies, and repositories that may help us in terms of kind of curating this cultural content. But at the moment, we're thinking of having stuff on our website, deep archiving to DSpace, which at the moment allows material to be very visible, totally visible, or totally invisible, but not a kind of tiered level access apart from Cambridge level authentication. I think for some of our needs, we may have to have a more nuanced level of access for communities who want a certain part of the collection to be visible to them, a certain part to researchers, a certain part totally not. So we have to think, but we have to think increasingly of collection management systems that are not all or nothing, but are that, you know, you put a bit here, a bit there, that different components offer different kinds of strengths. We're working very closely with the Endangered Languages Program at SOAS, who have precisely that kind of textured, layered way of accessing information. So the depositor can set the protocol for any single bit stream. Right? You can say, that bit, nobody should see. But this bit, everybody can, and that one, only 30%, but they have to email me first. And it's all very nicely handled, well-designed. I think it's in one of these content management systems, but it's well done. There are also other things for kind of delivering cultural content online, which involves time coding. So a lot of people are working now intensively trying to get their data time coded so that they've got transcript that relates to video. This is one. Another one is produced by the Smithsonian, which is all in Flash, and you really can't get into it, but it's quite interesting. There's a lot happening, but a lot of it isn't linked up, and it's not talking to each other. Finally, in terms of publishing, I think we need to move really fast away from the model of traditional academic scholarly publishing, whereby a text of 500 pages goes into a publisher in Europe who charges €200 for privilege. They produce 200 copies, sell to university libraries like Cambridge, and nobody else can get access. This cannot be the future of this kind of cultural content. It really does not gonna, it's not going to fly. The open book publishers are based in Cambridge, are very interesting and enterprising community of academics, who basically are trying to bring the cost of academic publishing down for things that otherwise wouldn't get published. Hardbacks at £25, paperbacks at £10, print on demand, free access online. I mean, it's really sensible, innovative stuff, but humanities have been slow to respond to the kinds of things that have been actually milling around in physics and mathematics for quite a long time. I'd like to show this slide partly, you know, because I'm a great DSpace user and abuser. I mean, I think Alan McFarlane, an anthropologist and myself, are kind of DSpace hogs, sucking up many terabytes of data. But, you know, this has been a great thing for us. We had a workshop last year, and as soon as I put this up, this video of one of the presentations by our keynote speaker, within a couple of days, it had been accessed 35 times. We've got people all over the world watching our content who otherwise wouldn't have been able to come to the workshop. So I'm very happy about that. Let me just fast forward you through this, because it's just a clip of the video, which I'm sure you can well imagine. But let me move on. That was Ruth Finnegan, who gave a very compelling talk about her work. We're putting together a database of levels of endangerment of languages, all culled from open source material, but we want to be able to make it available and accessible to others. We're most interested, to be honest, in not the endangerment levels, but what levels of existing collections are out there. Very small slide, for those of you who can't see it, apologies. Anthropologists don't even know where collections are, right? And sometimes they're in shoeboxes, sometimes they're in institutions. Before we fund urgent work in the field, we need to know what's been done already. Right? So that's our first task, a scoping exercise, essentially a lay of the land. So that's also something that we're doing. We come back to this collect, protect, connect. Well, I think to me it sums up what I've been doing and also what I think we should be doing as scholars. Let me show you something else. This is a man with whom my wife and I worked for a very, very long time. His name is Lati Apa. Lati refers to the head knot on his head. His hair is about 2 meters long. He's never cut it. He's a powerful shaman. He was a compelling storyteller and a master of symbolic manipulation. His magnetic appeal was not lost on my 2-year-old, who you see there on the right, who was admiring his head knot. And they developed a very close relationship. And the shaman, Lati Apa, from Darjeeling in eastern India, named my son Itihas, which is the word for history, because he said it was for my son and that generation of children that he was downloading, as he called it, all of his knowledge to my wife and myself. We were recording all of this. I show these photos in part to kind of acknowledge his kind of contribution, the kind of work that we've been doing, but also to show the fragility of these traditions. Lati Apa died tragically in a landslide last year in Darjeeling. His house was the only one washed away, and he was the only person who died. And the biggest question after his death was who was going to conduct his death ritual, because he was the only person who'd been conducting death rituals for 30 years in that community. So we live on the cusp of these transformative moments, and we have the privilege as a community of scholars, as anthropologists, to be there to record it, and also think, therefore, we have a responsibility to do something with our collections and with the data that we've gathered from communities. So there you go. Thank you very much for your time. And these are the two websites. Thank you.
question. Speak. If you don't, I will. What are you thinking? Can I ask it? What are you describing in the Digital Himalayas project? In the normal kind of world of organisations, they would say, well, this is a 20-person project and each of them getting paid $50,000 a year. That's not what you run, is it?
No, no. At the moment, we have a web designer who is a work-study student at Cornell, who works for Time Warner Cable in New York, and on his weekends we send him a bit of money to do web updates. We have our team in Kathmandu, and we've got me here. So we're in three places, and sort of that's how
we
run
it. It's tiny.
It's tiny, yeah. It's tiny. There have been times of sort of massive industry, right? I mean, at Cornell and also at University of Virginia, you know, there have been times when people, tons of people were scanning and PDFing and things. But it's also, it's something that you can do. And the hidden cost, in fact, is that, of course, I'm employed by the university on a grant. So, you know, if you take that out of it, then could I do it from my home? I suppose I could. But, you know, that's kind of institutionally where it sits. And, you know, DSpace and university servers make it all possible for this to exist. But in terms of our team, yeah, it's all very part-time.
The other thing that I was very struck by was your emphasis on sustainability, because that's really hard. I don't think you should be embarrassed about using Amazon, for example, because those of us who are members of Wilson, every email we get from the bursar or indeed anybody else in office in this establishment contains an injunction to use Amazon to buy our books because the college gets 4%.
Damn it, competition!
Yeah, it's terrible. I think that's very clever and original
and
interesting and worth doing. I wish more academics would do things like that.
Right.
I would also put a PayPal up on my site, I think.
That's an interesting one. Okay.
These two.
No, but I think what if you just may sort of add to that, one of the problems is that this kind of thing is not easy to peer review and doesn't really go into the research assessment exercise. Maybe it'll go into the new thing, impact, I'm not sure. But how do you value this? How do you value the production of scholarly knowledge that is wider than the university, that isn't always original knowledge, but helping other people get access, right? It's kind of the service work that sits around. And when you turn your service job into your main job, then everybody says, oh my God, you know, this is 10-year death. You know, you're going to make yourself totally unemployable in a university anywhere in the world. The moment I'm not too worried, but I do think it's an interesting question. How do you value things that go beyond the normal remit of kind of academic publication?
I wouldn't worry about that. I've been unemployable for years.
No.
Right. Did you have something to say? Were you just looking at me meaningfully?
I was thinking something about that. I hadn't fully formulated the question. About the openness and yet the need for control.
Yes.
Because if you don't have some control, then the whole project falls. So whether, you know, in some senses, openness is a luxury. Not exactly a luxury, but that was as far as I've got.
We do turn down collections. I mean, the interesting kind of questions that happen around control are when we receive emails from people saying, can you take something down? Now, one of the questions was early on, with this PDFing, should we have asked every single author in every single journal whose collections we house, whether or not we can put it online? Obviously, we should have done. But those journals never asked them, you know, sometimes to sign anything. And half of these authors you can't find anymore, and many of them are dead. So we thought, let's put it up and see what happens. We received joyful emails from people who said, oh my golly, I found my publication that I myself have lost. The takedowns we get are actually very interesting ones. People who publish something in a newspaper and either no longer agree with it or feel that it misrepresented them, or want to kind of update it. And I say, look, that's not for us to manage. You deal with the publisher. If they want to reissue or offer an addendum or some kind of apology to you, we'll host that too. But we don't publish it. We simply kind of host it. But are we in a way publishing it by hosting it online? So that's a question. The other issue is that of takedowns in terms of kind of intellectual property. We had Cornell, you can imagine their legal counsel are very concerned about doing this, and a lot of the digitization of PDFs happened at Cornell. So we got very, very clear agreements from all the publishers and the editorial boards that this stuff could be hosted online. There was a fight in for one of the journals or collections we house between two parts of the family who both think they inherited the fortune, and they wanted to sell it to us rather than give it to us. And that, I think, does often happen. People think that their material is worth something. Of course, it's worth something, but is it worth anything that can be monetized is another question. that, you know, like the National Health Service, this project is predicated on kind of no money changing hands at the point of delivery. That's, that, you know, there's obviously, there are costs which are ingested, but
yeah,
if we charged 1 rupee for anything, I think we'd be in very tricky waters. At the moment, somehow, I think we're still just about okay. But control, yeah. That's
Can I just comment?
Oh, yeah.
On the aspect of whether you're publishing or not, from a legal point of view, you are, as we are with DSpace as well.
Yeah, okay.
Although, I mean, it sort of feels like you're just making things available.
No, sure.
But in fact, and we've explored this to some degree with DSpace.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in DSpace, I mean, in your workflow, you have to grant the license, right? It's the most important part of it, to grant the license, and that's something that we don't formalise in our digital collections at the moment.
It's something that you don't really think about when you normally do, but anything you're putting online on internet that everybody in the world can access is actually legally published, which brings all sorts of other legal problems about images and ownership. You can think back to the Facebook issue that you mentioned before. So, and we still don't know where that's going to take us. I don't think it should stop us from doing it.
I think flag it up and tread cautiously, but I must say I think some of the debate's been pushed open in innovative ways. If you look at the British Library Sound Archive, there's a lovely little takedown blurb which says, "We're doing this in good faith. If you think it's wrong, write to us, we'll take it down." I think that's such a generous way of thinking about access, rather than saying, you know, we're scared of everything and, you know, we're not going to do anything at all. So, you know, Flickr, Facebook, if you want to look for, you know, nasty things, you can find it. You know, we're not the place. So in that way, we're responsive to takedown requests, but I think we'd like to sort of think open and then close down as needed.
Can I ask another
question? Please do.
I mean, some of the regions that you're working in is regions where there are conflict. You mentioned China and Tibet. And
absolutely.
And in the previous organisation that I worked in, we had an incident where we put a massive thesis from Nepal online and had to later take it down because the student who made it was Nepalese, and the fact that the Nepalese authorities could get to it because it was online actually put this person in danger because there was controversial content in it.
Okay.
Have you ever had issues like that?
That's
and
interesting.
How,
yeah.
How would you regulate those things? Could they then monitor?
Right. Well, in terms of publications, I mean, we're only hosting things that are already kind of published in print form, so we'd hope that kind of, if there's going to be a backlash, that would have happened at that point, and we then have a sort of time lag before we host it. In terms of the kind of cultural content, so films and videos of, you know, of local traditions, of ritual performances, of songs and dances, we've not had emails to that effect, but I mean, we could one day be asked to take it down.
I should perhaps add that part of, I mean, it was publicly available in Norway, but
yeah.
The Nepalese government doesn't monitor a lot of output from Norway in paper much. Because it's not practical. But when you put it online, the accessibility changes
so
dramatically. But
of course. Yeah.
That was
I mean, one option for us to explore, we haven't done it, is that you would have sort of viewing copies, right? You can't download it, you can view it streaming or some other way, or there's a digital watermark on it, or you can't print it. So obviously with PDF you can set all these levels whatever you want. Our default has been to ask people to have it fully open. With the oral literature project, we're going to have much more interesting questions about kind of, you know, visibility, ownership and intellectual property, particularly of living traditions, right? So that's where we're going to have a much more tiered and nuanced system of access and control. But yeah, these are problems, these are systemic problems and interesting questions as well.
I'm a librarian at the African Studies Centre.
Yes.
Interested in the oral literature project. At the moment, there isn't, well, from what I can see, not very much African content.
You're right, only
Is
one.
There being
Yes, there have been. I mean, you know, again, it's simply, it's our own ignorance of the matter. We've got, well, you'll know Roger Blench, and, you know, Roger has applied for a grant. We've got a project working in Malawi right now, a very interesting documentation project. So yes, it's getting, you know, getting more visible, and we're very eager to support parts of the world that, you know, we haven't represented yet. So definitely, and actually, to be honest, oral literature is alive and well in the African Academy, right? I mean, there's a lot of scholars in Africa who do work on this, where it's a term that doesn't resonate so strongly with other parts of the world. So please do let your colleagues and friends and networks know about it.
Yeah, I think some of academics are not necessarily very aware of
No, right. I mean, it's, if you would, I mean, it's hard for us to contact people we don't even know who they are to contact, as it were. So that would be great. Thank you.
Dan, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was going to ask about this issue that sometimes comes up in projects that deal with lots of source communities.
Mm.
around the idea of sort of physical location of the digital data, the machines, and sort of issues around ownership as well of the actual physical infrastructure. Has that come up in this
Okay,
project?
Yes, no, that's, thank you for the question because it gives me a chance to talk about it just a little bit. So on our website and on our granting page, you make it very clear we do not hold copyright or exert any intellectual property over the material. So we sort of see ourselves as the custodians. Yeah? We don't want the originals unless they want to give us them. But, I mean, what is an original anyway when you're dealing with a 3 gigabyte audio file? So, yes, give us a copy. Keep one yourself. We'd like to put it on DSpace. If you want it to be open, we'll do that. If you want it to be closed, we'll ask that, you know. If you want something more textured, we'll hand you over to SOAS. So we see ourselves as a conduit for this information. We'd like to host some of it on our website. But we don't ever want to get into the situation of where we are managing the access permissions, right, for them. That's got to be run essentially by the community or by the grantee if they're not from the community themselves. That's been our model to date. An interesting issue is actually about equipment, right? What do you do with the recording equipment, video cameras and things? And we've been eager to say, either give it back to us to recycle to our next grantee or leave it with the community. But what is a community? I mean, let's be clear, they're not always bounded things. There are problems and rifts within communities. I know that in the small communities I've worked with. So you give it to one person, it means somebody else won't have access to it. None of it's easy to solve, but I think it's far better than a whole lot of old equipment sitting around in Cambridge archives. Yeah.
Have the same issues arisen at a much more sort of physical level, about sort of the location of the servers? And people have said, you know, although you enter into, say, a legal agreement, if it's sort of very sort of, if there's two cultures that are a long way apart,
right,
they may say, you know, we actually want the thing, we actually want to.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
This
discussion is far more advanced and very nuanced in the museum communities, right? Where particularly the idea is kind of cultural repatriation and objects and things like that is very, very hot and massively important. For us, it hasn't come up yet, and I think in large part because the two parts of the world that one immediately thinks of in this regard, the North Americas, right, with a lot of indigenous communities who have very strong voices about cultural ownership, and also Australia and New Zealand. We haven't actually funded any projects in there because nobody's applying to us yet. I mean, I think they can have their own funding visibility circles. So, you know, we're I think, trying to support community groups and also projects that fall through the gaps that otherwise wouldn't get funded. If it comes to that, you know, servers, where is the server going to be located, right? Who's going to have the original data file? I'd rather that they would have them and we would have a copy, right? I don't feel the need that we own it in any way or that we host the original. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Simply that we provide a service that is commensurate with their need. Yeah? And if, I mean, one grantee or one project has set up a blog and they're hosting everything there, so fantastic. You know, you do it then, we'll link to you. We don't need to pull it into us, we'll link to you. If that's how you want to do it, we'll do it that way. The priority is to fund the work, and then in a way that the relationship about what happens to the collection, I think, will follow from each individual case. Yeah.
Digital layers,
yes.
Obviously a defined geographical region.
Yes.
Do you have a vision for how this project could be enlarged to encompass, you know, much larger areas of the world? How do you see museums, librarians, academics working together to do that?
Yeah, I'm flattered for the question, although I'm not sure I have a very meaningful or useful answer. I showed the project to colleagues from Mongolia recently, and one of them immediately said, "Oh, we want this. You know, give us digital Himalaya Mongolia, digital Mongolia." And he was almost buying the domain already. I said, "You have no idea what you're getting into. You know, I mean, this is a bugbear. This is a beastly thing. You know, please do not replicate all our errors. You know, and it's kind of gone very lopsided in certain ways." I think the strongest things are ones that cohere around a region or a sub-discipline or something, right? I mean, that's why it works in part, because it is bounded. Yeah, you can stretch the Himalayas a little bit. We've got some stuff from Borneo. Should we have it online? Probably not. Would anybody else host it? No. So, you know, there we go. But essentially, I think that's the strength of it. And you see a lot of interesting projects which are a little bit like this. I think our sort of JSTOR angle on it is one that I haven't seen replicated in many other projects, although maybe that's there, I just don't know about it. You know, Africa, for example, has all kinds of, you know, ethnomusicology collections, and, you know, there are these Cinderella projects, right, which are either very regional or very subfield specific. I don't think that we have any template for how to do it, apart from to say, think about sustainability, and you might find unusual sources of support. Right? I mean, every country has wealthy people, every region has wealthy people. You might find people who want access to that. And the other one is this kind of model of co-hosting, right? The Journal of Bhutan Studies, some of you may know Bhutan, it's a fiercely independent and proud nation, and I wrote to the Journal of Bhutan Studies one day and said, maybe we could co-host your journal. And they said, totally ridiculous, we have a perfectly good server, no need. Right? So fine, Next week their server went down for 2 years. So they wrote to me and said, maybe you could host our journal. And this is kind of how these things happen. And then that sort of sustained and that continues. Now, one day, if they say our server's good enough, take it down, we will. So it's the flexibility, right? It's the willingness to set something up and see where it goes and not lock yourself into very rigid agreements about where you're going to be in a few years, I think. So you have to be able to deploy, fast and move fast. And I suppose the university gives you the framework to do that.
I was very struck by one of the things you said, which was this thing about archives used to be places where things went to die.
Mm.
And digital archives are places where they go to essentially live in different ways.
Mm.
Do you have any interesting cases of people taking the stuff and then reusing it in some creative way? Or is it mainly access?
That's a good question. At the moment, Digital Himalaya was just, in a way, putting stuff online that was already available. It was already packaged material, in a way, an article with a finite end. I think we're going to see more of that in the oral literature project. We have a few people who write into us saying, can we use some of the audio or kind of in a mashup, or can we use it for a music CD or those kinds of things? And that's interesting. I usually just pass them straight back to the depositor and say, you negotiate that. We're happy with it, but you negotiate it. I think that's going to happen more with the kind of original content that's going to be generated in the field. For many scholars, and I think of linguistics now, archives are where the interaction happens. It's where you interact with your data, where you come up with your analysis, where you ask the archive to do some analysis for you, and also where you link in with community partners, because they have access to the same archive. And the Max Planck Institute in Nijmegen has set up a whole parallel archive in some of the countries that it works in, precisely for the reason of kind of ownership that you mentioned, Dan. Like, where's the archive? I want one here. But also for the sense that people can work on their own collections in their own countries. But it requires quite a level of sort of software engineering to develop tools that different kinds of computer users can work with comfortably. I think that's important.
And was the Nepalese diaspora important in the growth of the...
Very much so. Actually, that's a good point. It was very important, both financially, because some of them are funding the project, and also because they're the kind of people who are very eager to be connected with the homeland. They're getting their news digests or their kind of academic feed through places like our website, not only, but... diaspora communities are very important, actually. Often very educated and very connected with kind of cultural politics as well. Shania? Right, well, there are two answers to that. Firstly, many of the projects that we... Well, actually, all the projects we fund have to have a component about, the non-archival part of it, right? What are you going to do with the materials? So is there going to be a local cultural community archive, or is it going to be deposited in a box in somebody's house, or what? We're very eager, and we fund different kinds of things. So some people actually applying to us for funding to set up their own community archive in a village. And that way. Now, we can't mandate or control access from Cambridge. I think we have to subcontract that responsibility to people and trust that it's going to work. If it doesn't work, we'd like to hear about it. But I think the other thing is, in a way, that's asking too much of us. That's giving us too much power to think about how we might legislate that. I mean, we should support it, we should fund it, and we should hope that things are disseminated properly. Right? But, every context is so different. Even in the three communities I've worked in Nepal, they're so different. I couldn't possibly come up with one-size-fits-all model. I'm happy to say that most of the grantees that we're working with are actually either from the place or have long-term relationships with the place and want their materials to exist there. Other times, it's a more problematic issue because I've had this as well, that a knowledge producer, a singer, a performer, a shaman wants to give you the content but doesn't want... Right? People in the community to have free access, right? That erodes some of his prestige and his visibility. So that's why it's not for us to mandate. He says, by all means, you put it online, I'm never going to see that, but don't give it to my neighbour, damn it. Yeah? So we've got to be responsive to that as well, and I think we have to be light in our touch. And hopefully our grantees will be responsible as well.
Well, in that case, we've obviously made a very bad mistake in bringing you here. because you've just given away all the secrets that
the
crown
jewels.
Yeah. No, can I just first of all thank you for coming. The thing that attracted me about this from the beginning, because I'm an engineer, was that that wonderful illustration you had of the anthropology seminar room at 3 a.m.
Mm.
Because the thing that I felt was remarkable about this project was its spirit, which was just do it. And that's kind of alien to some of our university cultures. So, Mark, thank you very much. Thank you for coming, folks.
Thank
Don't
you.
Forget Geth 2.0 in 2 weeks. And have a drink beforehand. Thank you.